when she turned to me and said, "You see those people? They're fighting for us, for our dreams." That day, I learned I was undocumented, and I wanted nothing more than to be marching with those people and to feel like I finally belong somewhere. I always knew I was different. My Ecuadorian feature set me apart from the predominantly white, rural area which my family had settled in. But even then, I knew my feelings of not belonging stemmed from a more precarious place. It was a place I didn't know how to name or how to describe. I just knew that when my parents kissed me, it always felt like it could be the last time. I could be separated from them at any moment and be forced to go to a country I didn't know. Once I got to high school, my feelings of not belonging became even more inescapable. I realized that I didn't have the same opportunities as my friends and peers, such as getting a driver's license, applying to college, or even receiving financial aid. After I lived through 15 years of being undocumented, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, program allowed me to come out of the shadows and pursue my dreams. I was able to apply to the University of Virginia, and I was accepted. Shortly after, I became a U.S. permanent resident, a privilege I do not take lightly, as it's not afforded to many of my family members, friends, and community members. Even though I was no longer undocumented, the trauma that came from living most of my life in limbo followed me into college. I longed to share my story and to build meaningful connections with others, but my fear of not belonging, coupled with the lack of diversity at my university, prevented me from doing so. After several months of contemplating dropping out, I told my story to one of my friends, who confided in me that her family was also undocumented. It was the first time I had shared my experiences and identity with anyone other than my own family. That night, we recounted moments of injustice and bigotry we endured within our conservative towns and drew similarities of feeling that way at our university. We identified a lack of awareness and support for undocumented students and eventually invited others into the conversation. Within a couple of weeks, we met several undocumented students and together created a student advocacy organization to help uplift their voices and concerns at UVA. Years later, this organization has spearheaded actions that have cultivated political and cultural systemic change, not only on campus, but also in the surrounding communities and the state of Virginia as a whole. In many Latin American countries, we have a saying that goes, ni de aquí, ni de allá, meaning, not from here, not from there. I still resonate with this saying, even though I've been documented for nearly 8 years. I don't know if I'll ever feel like I belong to this country or another, but what I do know is that I belong to myself. The accepting, loving space my friend and I provided each other that night sparked a fire inside me to connect with and advocate alongside others facing structural inequities. It's been the honor of my life to help create brave spaces of belonging for those ready to share their stories. Together, we fight to create change within ourselves and our communities, because as my favorite quote says, quisieron enterrarnos, pero no sabían que éramos semillas. They wanted to bury us, but they didn't know we were seeds.
Is that a remarkable story from Paola? I'll never forget. They wanted to bury us, but they didn't know we were seeds. Just such grace and generosity in sharing with us. So a huge thank you to Paola. Let's talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And I want to start with a quote from my friend and co-editor of the anthology we did together, You Are Your Best Thing, Tarana Burke. You may know her name because she is the founder of the Me Too movement. I love this quote from Tarana because I think it really speaks to the work that we're doing in this book. She writes, "I don't believe your anti-racist work is complete or valid or even useful if you haven't engaged with Black humanity. In our Dare to Lead work, we talk a lot about belonging as a critical component of diversity, equity, and inclusion work, often known as DEI work. We actually call it DEIB, to include belonging, in our work, and our organization's position statement is called our belonging statement. Why? Because people should feel a strong sense of belonging in an organization and shape the culture through representation, co-creation, influence, and that inextricable, unnameable, spiritual connection that is shared humanity. Anything less is not enough. Aiko Bethia is a Dare to Lead facilitator and an expert in DEIB work. She's also a tremendous thought partner and teacher when it comes to bringing belonging to organizational cultures. If you're interested in the intersection of belonging, leadership, and culture, I recommend listening to the two-part Dare to Lead podcast that we did together. It's a tremendous resource for teams to listen to together and then discuss. Now that we've talked about belonging and belonging uncertainty and how that works with the intersection of diversity, equity, and inclusion, I want to get down a level and talk about connection and disconnection. One of the interesting things about grounded theory research, and I'm a grounded theory researcher, PS, so this is why I think this is important. One of the interesting things is that unlike the majority of other research methodologies, we don't start with a review of the existing literature. Barney Glaser and Anselm Strauss developed grounded theory in 1967, and through a very strange turn of events, Barney Glaser served as the methodologist on my dissertation committee. I remember him telling me, "How do you know what literature to review before you start? You don't get to decide what this research is about. Your participants do. You'll follow them where they go, not the other way around. This is based on their lived experiences, not the researcher's academic pet interests. Trust and follow what emerges from the data." True confession, at first I thought, awesome, lit reviews are so time consuming. Well, it turns out that once your theory or hypothesis emerges from the data, you're required to do an entire literature analysis, not just a review, an analysis to understand how your theory fits with or pushes against what other researchers have found. And because you didn't start by following existing lines of inquiry, grounded theories often support, refute, and challenge in equal measure. This is where, if you could see my face right now reading this to you, or you insert anxious emoji face, like when you do grounded theory research, there is a 90% chance, because you're not starting with existing research, you're starting with people's experiences, that you're going to end up with a theory that pushes against what's out there. After my first study on shame and connection, I tiptoed into the literature to see where existing work aligned with what I had found and where it didn't. Early in that process, I found relational cultural theory and the group of researchers and clinicians behind it from the Stone Center at Wellesley. It felt like home. There was a theory that was also built from lived experiences and, as Maureen Walker described it, depicted culture as more than the scenic backdrop for the unfolding of development. Rather, culture is viewed as an active agent in relational processes that shape human possibilities. Let me read this quote from Maureen again, because it's so powerful if you pull it apart a little bit. So at the Stone Center at Wellesley, they built theories that depicted culture as more than just a backdrop for what was happening in the research, but rather culture became an active agent and shaped everything that was happening in the research. And that is absolutely aligned with my work. The relational cultural theorist Judith Jordan writes, "The need for connection, in which growth is a priority, is the core motivation in people's lives. In growth-fostering relationships, people are able to bring themselves most fully and authentically into connection." From an evolution perspective, connection was about survival. Today, it's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. Research shows that people who have strong connections with others are happier, healthier, and better able to cope with the stresses of everyday life. Across my research, I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and when they derive sustenance and strength from the relationship. Connection is in our neurobiology. This is why our experiences of disconnection are so painful and why chronic disconnection leads to social isolation, loneliness, and feelings of powerlessness. Here's how Judith Jordan, again from the Stone Center at Wellesley, explains disconnection. Relational cultural theory sees disconnection as normative and inevitable in relationships. They occur when one person misunderstands, invalidates, excludes, humiliates, or injures the other person in some way. Acute disconnections occur frequently in all relationships. If they can be addressed and reworked, they are not problematic. In fact, they become places of enormous growth. When an injured person, particularly one who has less power, can represent their experience of disconnection or pain to the more powerful person and be responded to with interest or concern, the less powerful hurt person has a sense of mattering, of having an effect on the other. This strengthens connection as well as a sense of relational competence. Jordan goes on to explain that when disconnection is not addressed, as frequently occurs in unequal power structures, chronic disconnection and disempowerment arise and the person, quote, often loses touch with their own feelings and inner experience. This is such a powerful example of how disconnection from another person can create disconnection within ourselves. One of the most important learnings to come out of the research for this book is how to recognize, name, and talk about my feelings of disconnection. I think we underestimate how much disconnection hurts. And it hurts more than our feelings. It can cause physical pain. Disconnection is often equated with social rejection, social exclusion, and/or social isolation. And these feelings of disconnection actually share the same neural pathways with feelings of pain. Current neuroscience research shows that the pain and feelings of disconnection are often as real as physical pain. And just as healing physical pain requires describing it, talking about it, and sometimes getting professional help, we need to do the same thing with emotional pain. There are a couple of serious watchouts when it comes to disconnection. The first comes from researcher Tricia Rocky. She writes, quote, "To avoid the pain and vulnerability that may result when their efforts to achieve connection are unsuccessful, individuals may enact their own disconnection strategies, such as hiding parts of themselves or discounting their need for others. They may learn that it is safer to keep their feelings and thoughts to themselves, rather than sharing them in relationships. This means that rather than making a bid for connection and having the bid ignored or rejected, we hide out or pretend we don't need anyone. I think most of us have done this. I know I have. It's a recipe for loneliness and, for me, blame. I can withhold a bid for connection, then blame someone for not responding. It's just a lot of scrambling to avoid being hurt, and it doesn't even work. The second watchout is about perfectionism. There's actually a perfectionism social disconnection model. And this research shows that people who are high on the perfectionistic traits scale behave in ways that cause perceived and actual exclusion and rejection by others. In other words, my perfectionism drives me to show up in ways that lead people to push me away. This doesn't surprise me, but it's still painful to think about. Because ultimately, our perfectionism is about trying to avoid being excluded or rejected. Even though I've studied some of these topics for years, the process of writing this book led me to make connections and see relationships that have somehow escaped me, such as the symmetry of these findings. Authenticity is a requirement for belonging, and fitting in is a threat. Authenticity is a requirement for connection, and perfectionism, which is a type of fitting in, is a threat. That's big, right? Authenticity is a requirement for belonging, and fitting in is a threat. Authenticity is a requirement for connection, and perfectionism, which is a type of fitting in, is a threat. Speaking of, let's go to the next section, which is insecurity. So we use the term insecure a lot. I'm feeling really insecure. Oh my God, they're acting so insecure. He's super insecure. Do you think she just feels insecure? We normally use it to refer to self-doubt or a lack of confidence, but there's way more to it. There are three types of insecurity. Let's go through them. Number one, domain-specific insecurity occurs when we are insecure about a specific domain or resource in life. For example, food insecurity, financial insecurity, or a lack of physical safety. Combating domain-specific insecurity is about access and resources. Here's an example of how the term food insecurity is used in a report by Feeding America. Quote, in early 2020, COVID began to spread across the United States, and one of the results was an economic recession that ended years of declining rates of food insecurity. The lack of access to sufficient food because of limited financial resources. First, domain-specific insecurity. An example, food insecurity, financial insecurity. We're insecure in one area. Number two, relationship or interpersonal insecurity. This occurs when we don't feel like we have a supportive or trusting relationship. It can happen either in a specific relationship or as an overarching feeling about all of our relationships. It makes us feel uncertain about being loved, trusted, protected, and valued. This kind of insecurity varies based on the relationship partner. So an example might be, I feel really insecure about my relationship with Deepa. Sometimes she seems really interested in me. Other times I feel like I'm just bugging her. So we've got one, domain-specific insecurity, two, relationship or interpersonal insecurity, and then three is general or personal insecurity, and this occurs when we are overly critical of our weaknesses. This may include being overly critical of our body image or our performance at work. So an example is, oh, I feel really insecure when I have to present to my managers and the leadership team. I'm a terrible speaker. According to researchers Alice Wong and Howard Barenbaum, the opposite of personal insecurity is self-security, which they define as the open and non-judgmental acceptance of one's own weaknesses. What's really interesting about their research finding is that we can have high self-esteem, but still be insecure if we're overly critical of our imperfections. Because our self-esteem is an assessment of who we are and what we've accomplished compared to our values and our goals, even with high self-esteem, we can still feel insecure if we're self-critical. God, that's so powerful. I'm going to read it again because I can't tell you how many times, and not just, I wish I could just say in my work, but also in my life, where I would think to myself, I have a very solid high self-esteem, but why am I feeling so insecure? Or, you know, so-and-so seems to have such good self-esteem, but they are so insecure. I mean, this was so clarifying for me. I never really got it. Let me read the paragraph again. I'm going back to research from Alice Wong and Howard Barenbaum. What's interesting about their research findings is that we can have high self-esteem, but still be insecure if we're overly critical of our imperfections. Here's why. Because our self-esteem is an assessment of who we are and what we've accomplished compared to our values and goals. But even though we think a lot of our self-esteem and we think a lot of ourselves because we've accomplished a lot based on our values and goals, if we're self-critical, we still feel insecure. Stop. So in their initial studies, Wong and Barenbaum found that self-security, remember self-security, that's like the opposite of perfectionism. It's being open and non-judgmental about your own, you know, your own cracks and messiness. So that self-security is positively correlated with self-compassion, meaning the more self-secure you are, the more open and non-judgmental you are about the messy and imperfect parts of yourself, the more compassionate you are with yourself. And the more accepting you are of your imperfections, the less you experience shame proneness, neuroticism, fear of negative evaluation, self-aggrandizement, and relationship conflict. They also found that people who are more secure are willing to be more vulnerable with others. Their findings suggest that if we are comfortable with our own messiness, our own imperfections, if we're self-secure, we are more successful at being emotionally close to others and more likely to have healthy relationships. What really strikes me here is how feelings of both personal and interpersonal insecurity might cause us to behave in ways that push others away or to pull away from others out of the fear of being rejected. It's similar to what we learned about the relationship between perfectionism and disconnection. Without awareness, our fear of being hurt can actually push us to show up in ways that increase the certainty that we'll be hurt. Let's talk about invisibility. Given that we are all here to be seen, known, and loved, invisibility is one of the most painful human experiences. I define invisibility as a function of disconnection and dehumanization where an individual or group's humanity and relevance are unacknowledged, ignored, and/or diminished in value or importance. Let me define that again for you because it's the worst of us, I think, when we treat others as if they're invisible. The definition, it's a function of disconnection and dehumanization where an individual or a group's humanity and relevance are unacknowledged, ignored, and/or diminished in value or importance. Researchers Rebecca Neal and Bethany Lassiter discuss findings across multiple fields, including psychology and sociology, that addresses invisibility in terms of stigma and stereotypes. They offer several examples, such as not getting proper credit for spoken or written material, having limited or negative cultural representations of the group you belong to, experiencing outright discrimination, or being viewed as a symbol of your overall group without being recognized as an individual. Just as there are different types of insecurity, there are different types of invisibility. There's interpersonal invisibility, which is invisibility between people. There's group invisibility and representational invisibility. Neal and Lassiter explain, when a group is invisible, instead of being actively discriminated against and targeted with negative prejudices, members of that group are ignored and overlooked. Invisibility may manifest as being passed over for promotions and recognition, not being seen as a viable friend, romantic partner, or teammate, or being passively excluded from social situations. It's important to understand that invisibility is its own form of stigma. Many individuals who are members of marginalized groups find themselves caught in an ever-tightening vice of two types of dehumanization, stereotyping and invisibility. Let's now move to the next section, which is loneliness. I researched loneliness for over a year when I was writing Braving the Wilderness. I'm going to recap what I learned with you here and share some new data. Even before the COVID pandemic, government and public health officials were calling loneliness a significant health threat. John Cacioppo founded the field of social neuroscience, and he fundamentally changed the way researchers and clinicians understand loneliness. He dedicated his career to scientific inquiry and to helping us understand what it means to be human. He died in 2018. And though I didn't know him, his work has forever shaped my understanding of loneliness. The information that I'm getting ready to read to you is from Braving the Wilderness. Cacioppo and his colleague, William Patrick, defined loneliness as perceived social isolation. We experience loneliness when we feel disconnected. Maybe we've been pushed to the outside of a group that we value, or maybe we're lacking a sense of true belonging. At the heart of loneliness is the absence of meaningful social interaction, an intimate relationship, friendships, family gatherings, or even community or work group connections. It's important to note that loneliness and being alone are very different things. Being alone or inhabiting solitude can be a powerful and healing thing. As an introvert, I deeply, deeply value alone time. And sometimes the most lonely feelings that I have happen when I'm with other people. While there remains deep alignment between what I've found in my research and what Cacioppo has found, it wasn't until I processed his work that I fully understood the important role that loneliness plays in our lives. He explains that as members of a social species, we don't derive strength from our rugged individualism, but rather from our collective ability to plan, communicate, and work together. Our neural, hormonal, and genetic makeup support interdependence over independence. Cacioppo explains, quote, "To grow into an adulthood for a social species, including humans, is not to become autonomous and solitary. It's to become the one on whom others can depend. Whether we know it or not, our brain and our biology have been shaped to favor this outcome." Oh, God, it's so good. Of course we're a social species. That's why connection matters. It's why shame is so painful and debilitating. It's why we're wired for belonging. Cacioppo explains how the biological machinery of our brains warns us when our ability to thrive and prosper is threatened. Hunger is a warning that our blood sugar is low and that we need to eat. Thirst warns us that we need to drink to avoid dehydration. Pain alerts us to the potential tissue damage. And loneliness tells us that we need social connection, something as critical to our well-being as food and water. He explains, quote, "Denying you feel lonely makes no more sense than denying you feel hungry." Yet we do deny our loneliness. As someone who studies shame, I find myself back in territory that I know well. We feel shame around being lonely, as if feeling lonely means there's something wrong with us. We feel shame even when our loneliness is caused by grief or loss or heartbreak. Cacioppo believes much of the stigma around loneliness comes from how we have defined it and talked about it for years. We used to define loneliness as a, quote, "gnawing chronic disease without redeeming features," end quote. I mean, loneliness at one time was equated with shyness, depression, being a loner or antisocial, or possessing bad social skills. Cacioppo gives a great example of this by noting how often we use the term loner to describe a criminal or a bad guy. Cacioppo explains that loneliness is not just a sad condition, it's a dangerous one. The brains of social species have evolved to respond to the feeling of being pushed to the social perimeter or being on the outside by going into self-preservation mode. When we feel isolated, disconnected, and lonely, we try to protect ourselves. In that mode of self-protection, we want to connect, but our brain is attempting to override connection with self-protection. That means less empathy, more defensiveness, more numbing, and less sleeping. Unchecked loneliness fuels continued loneliness by keeping us afraid to reach out. To combat loneliness, we must first learn how to identify it and have the courage to see that experience of loneliness is a warning sign. Our response to that warning sign should be to find connection. That doesn't necessarily mean joining a bunch of groups or checking in with dozens of friends. Numerous studies confirm that it's not the quantity of friends, but the quality of a few relationships that actually matters. If you're anything like me and you find yourself questioning the idea that starvation and loneliness are equally life-threatening, let me share the study that really brings all of this home for me. In a meta-analysis of studies on loneliness, and a meta-analysis, again, is just a study of studies. So in a meta-analysis of studies on loneliness, researchers Julianne Holt Lundstad, Timothy B. Smith, and J. Bradley Layton found the following. Living with air pollution increases your odds of dying early by 5%. Living with obesity, 20%. Excessive drinking, 30%. And living with loneliness, it increases our odds of dying early by 45%. In early 2020, one of the first guests on Unlocking Us was Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy, He talked about his new book, Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. In a 2017 Harvard Business Review article, Dr. Murthy writes, quote, "During my years caring for patients, the most common pathology I saw was not heart disease or diabetes. It was loneliness. The elderly man who came to our hospital every few weeks seeking relief from chronic pain was also looking for human connection. He was lonely. The middle-aged woman battling advanced HIV, who had no one to call to inform that she was sick, she was lonely too. I found that loneliness was often in the background of clinical illness, contributing to disease and making it harder for patients to cope and heal." Dr. Murthy confirms the connection between loneliness and our physical health, explaining that loneliness is associated with a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, depression, and anxiety. And at work, he states that loneliness, quote, "reduces task performance, limits creativity, and impairs other aspects of executive function, such as reasoning and decision making." We got to take loneliness serious. Like, there's not a research study I've read in the last 5 years that does not tell me that it is a formidable threat to our well-being and has gotten worse since the pandemic. So really important to understand what is loneliness, what isn't, and how do we build connection. Chapter 10, Places We Go When the Heart is Open. Love, lovelessness, heartbreak, trust, self-trust, betrayal, defensiveness, flooding, and hurt. I open this chapter on love with a quote from someone whose work has shaped, formed, and changed my life, the incredible Bell Hooks, who was generous enough to let me share this quote with you here. This is from her book, All About Love. "Everywhere we learn that love is important, and yet we are bombarded by its failure. In the realm of the political, among the religious, in our families, and in our romantic lives, we see little indication that love informs decisions, strengthens our understanding of community, or keeps us together. This bleak picture in no way alters the nature of our longing. We still hope that love will prevail. We still believe in love's promise." Distinguished emotions researcher Barbara Fredrickson describes the umbrella term love as including, quote, "the preoccupying and strong desire for further connection, the powerful bonds people hold with a select few and the intimacy that grows between them, the commitments to loyalty and faithfulness." In Fredrickson's view, love permeates everyday interactions with others, ranging from strangers and acquaintances to friends and spouses, forming the emotional context from which to strengthen relationships. Interestingly, there is debate among researchers about whether love is an emotion. That's me laughing, y'all. I'm going to read that sentence again, then I'm going to laugh again. Are you ready? Interestingly, there's a debate among researchers about whether love is an emotion. However, among everyone else, love is clearly thought of as an emotion. In a study conducted by Shaver and colleagues, undergraduates were asked to rate 213 emotion words in terms of whether they would call the word an emotion. One was, "I would definitely not call this an emotion," to 4, "I definitely would call this an emotion." The word love received the highest rating, 3.94 out of 4, beating the word hate, which scored 3.9 out of 4. You know, look, as someone who's committed to research that reflects our lived experiences, I find that Shaver's study and Fredrickson's description both align with what my team heard. Love is an emotion that we're capable of feeling in many different contexts, from intimate partner relationships and family bonds to friends and pets. It is always a risk to define a term like love. I personally think it might be best left to poets and artists and possibly yacht rock songwriters. However, a definition did emerge from our research, and it's withstood the test of new data. Here's the definition that emerged from our research. "We cultivate love when we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known. And when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from that offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection. Love is not something that we give or get. It's something that we nurture and grow. A connection that can be cultivated between two people only when it exists within each one of them. We can love others only as much as we love ourselves. Shame, blame, disrespect, betrayal, and the withholding of affection damage the roots from which love grows. Love can survive these injuries only if they're acknowledged, healed, and rare. That's our definition. And look, I'll confess that I don't think we'll ever be able to fully unravel the mysteries of love or, to be honest, many of the other emotions we experience. At least, I hope not. I mean, I think attempting to better understand ourselves and each other is essential, but I think mystery is also essential. Let's talk about lovelessness. The quote that opens this section on love is from Bell Hooks' book, All About Love. Hooks was a professor, social critic, and writer who, again, her work has shaped my life. In fact, I often say that her work is responsible for 90% of the stretch marks on my mind. As a first-time university teacher, I carried her book, Teaching to Transgress, with me at all times, and I slept with it next to me on my nightstand. She teaches that the injustice and systemic oppression that we see in the world today stem from a deep collective lovelessness. And she calls for an ethic of love. It sounds overly simplistic, but when you read her work, you understand that a love ethic is a rigorous calling. Hooks writes, "Refusal to stand up for what you believe in weakens individual morality and ethics as well as those of the culture. No wonder, then, that we are a nation of people, the majority of whom across race, class, and gender, claim to be religious, claim to believe in the divine power of love, and yet collectively remain unable to embrace a love ethic and allow it to guide behavior, especially if doing so would mean supporting radical change. Fear of radical changes leads many citizens of our nation to betray their minds and hearts." I don't want to betray my mind or my heart. I want to live by a love ethic. We need more love between us, but also among us. And not rainbow unicorn love or commercialized love. We need more real love, gritty, dangerous, wild-eyed, justice-seeking love. Let's talk about heartbreak. I researched heartbreak when I was writing Rising Strong. I learned that heartbreak is more than just a painful type of disappointment or failure. It hurts in a different way because heartbreak is always connected to love and belonging. Joe Reynolds, a retired Episcopal priest, has taught me the most about heartbreak. I shared his essay in Rising Strong, but I want to share it here again. I just don't think we can read it enough. So this is Joe's essay. "Heartbreak is an altogether different thing. Disappointment doesn't grow into heartbreak, nor does failure. Heartbreak comes from the loss of love or the perceived loss of love. My heart can be broken only by someone, or something like my dog, though a part of me really believes my dog's a person, to whom I have given my heart. There may be expectations, both met and unmet, in a relationship that ends in heartbreak. But disappointment is not the cause of the heartbreak. There may be failures within the relationship, indeed there certainly will be, for we are imperfect vessels to hold the love of another person. But the failures didn't cause the heartbreak. Heartbreak is what happens when love is lost. Heartbreak can come from being rejected by the one you love. The pain is more intense when you thought the other person loved you, but the expectation of returned love isn't necessary for heartbreak. Unrequited love can be heartbreaking. The death of a loved one is heartbreaking. I didn't expect them to live forever, and death is nobody's fault, regardless of smoking, bad diets, no exercise, or whatever. But my heart is broken anyway. A related heartbreak is the death of something unique, maybe even essential, in someone I love. I didn't want my children to stay children all their lives, but at times the loss of innocence was heartbreaking. The loss of love doesn't have to be permanent to be heartbreaking. Moving away from a loved one can break your heart. change in another person I love may be a good thing. It may be a significant personal growth, and I may be happy about it and proud of it. It can also change our relationship and break my heart. The list goes on. There is a plethora of ways in which a heart can be broken. The common denominator is the loss of love, or the perceived loss of love. To love with any level of intensity and honesty is to become vulnerable. I used to tell couples getting married that the only thing I could tell them with certainty was that they would hurt each other. To love is to know the loss of love. Heartbreak is unavoidable unless we choose not to love at all. A lot of people do just that. Every time we love, we risk heartbreak. Despite how lonely heartbreak feels, it's universal. I remember sitting next to a woman in an airport terminal waiting for our plane to board, and she started weeping. She was probably in her early 60s, and she was by herself. When I asked her if she was okay and if I could get her anything, she didn't reply. She just shook her head and looked away. I returned to reading my book until about 20 minutes later, the woman said, "We had to put our dog down. My heart is broken." She wasn't looking at me when she said it. She was looking straight ahead. I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry," and I squeezed her forearm. We ended up talking until we boarded, and when we deplaned in Houston, she gave me a hug. That happened about 15 years ago. I had never had a pet of my own at that point in my life, but having experienced heartbreak in several other contexts, I could connect with the sense of loss and longing that she was feeling. I didn't question her grief, but I remember thinking to myself, man, I am glad I do not have a dog. I don't think a dog would be worth heartbreak. Fast forward to 2 years ago, when my very first dog, Daisy, a rescue Bichon, got untreatable cancer after 10 healthy and wonderful years with us. The drive home from the vet's office without her was unbearable. That night, all four of us were sobbing in a big heap on the couch. I looked at my kids, who were inconsolable, and said, "We love Daisy so much. This is heartbreak." Then I looked over at Lucy, our second Bichon, who was also missing Daisy, and thought, God, this hurts. And it's totally worth it. As I often say, the brokenhearted are the bravest among us. They dared to love. Let's move to our next section, which is on trust. In The Thin Book of Trust, An Essential Primer for Building Trust at Work, author Charles Feltman defines trust as, quote, choosing to risk making something you value vulnerable to another person's actions. He defines distrust as a general assessment that what's important to me is not safe with this person in this situation or any situation. These definitions perfectly capture what emerged from our data on trust and mistrust. Trust is more of a cognitive assessment than an emotion. But as we all know, conversations about trust can bring up a lot of emotions, especially hurt and defensiveness. It's difficult to talk about trust in our personal or professional relationships because it's such a big concept. If someone says, "I don't trust you," it feels like a general assault on our character. We've spent the past 10 years trying to figure out exactly what constitutes trust. What are the specific behaviors we're talking about when we talk about trust? 7 elements of trust emerged from our data, and we use the acronym BRAVING to identify them. Let's go through it together. B, boundaries. You respect my boundaries, and when you're not clear about what's okay and not okay, you ask. You're willing to say no. R, reliability. You do what you say you'll do. At work, this means staying aware of your competencies and limitations so you don't overpromise and you're able to deliver on commitments and balance competing priorities. A is accountability. You own your mistakes, apologize, and make amends. The V in braving is vault. You don't share information or experiences that are not yours to share. I need to know that my confidences are kept and that you're not sharing with me any information about other people that should be confidential. The I in braving is integrity. You choose courage over comfort. You choose what's right over what's fun, fast, or easy, and you practice your values rather than simply professing them. The N is for non-judgment. I can ask for what I need, and you can ask for what you need. We can talk about how we feel without judgment. we can ask each other for help without judgment. And the last is the G, and that's for generosity. You extend the most generous interpretations possible to the intentions, words, and actions of others. When we bring Dare to Lead training into organizations, this is one of the most adopted tools. It gives us all a framework to get specific about what's working in our trust building and what needs our attention. I can say to someone, hey, we're working hard on developing trust in our relationship in these areas, and I feel like we need to work more in these areas. What's your experience? We most often think about trust between people and groups, but we often forget about the importance of self-trust. Self-trust is normally the first casualty of failure or mistakes. We stop trusting ourselves when we hurt others, get hurt, feel shame, or just question our worth. I recently celebrated 25 years of sobriety. And when I was reflecting on what that's meant in my life, I couldn't stop thinking about self-trust. Returning to the definition from Feltman that I read earlier, I realized that my sobriety has taught me that I can trust myself and my actions when it comes to protecting what I value. There are still occasions when I have to slow down and get intentional so I don't end up distrusting or betraying myself. But I know increased self-trust has been one of the biggest gifts of sobriety. Here's how we use the braving tool to think about self-trust. B, did I respect my own boundaries? Was I clear about what's okay and what's not okay? R, was I reliable? Did I do what I said I was going to do? A, did I hold myself accountable? V, did I respect the vault and share appropriately? I, did I act from integrity? N, did I ask for what I needed? And here's the big important question here. Was I non-judgmental about needing help? And then G, have I been generous to myself? So as we talk about trust, I think braving is an incredibly helpful framework for operationalizing what is a big, emotionally loaded word. So we can't talk about trust without talking about betrayal, and that's the next section in the book. The quote that opens up that section is actually a quote from Suzanne Collins, who wrote the book The Hunger Games. She writes, "For there to be betrayal, there would have to have been trust first." Betrayal is so painful because at its core, it's a violation of trust. It happens in relationships in which trust is expected and assumed. So when it's violated, we're often shocked and we can struggle to believe what's happening. It can feel as if the ground beneath us has given way. Most betrayals happen among spouses, romantic partners, friends, coworkers, and occasionally family members. The most common types of betrayals include extramarital affairs or cheating on a steady dating partner, lying, betraying confidences, and rejecting or abandoning a partner. When betrayal is the result of physical or sexual abuse perpetrated by a trusted partner or family member, such as in the case of domestic violence or child abuse perpetrated by a parent, it's referred to as betrayal trauma. When we're injured by betrayal, we can suffer high levels of anxiety, depression, anger, sadness, jealousy, decreased self-worth, embarrassment, humiliation, shame, and even trauma symptoms. When I read these symptoms, the first thing I thought about was the times I've betrayed myself. As we just covered, self-trust is so important. And when we violate that, often to make someone else happy or in a bid for acceptance, I think we can feel self-betrayal too. There have been times in my life when I have said something that I didn't believe or I did something I didn't want to do in order to avoid feeling left out. The harshest consequence of that for me was dealing with my own betrayal. I've been thinking a lot about Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles pulling out of competitions to protect their mental and emotional well-being. God, it's so inspiring to watch these women choose to disappoint others and endure this kind of cheap seat criticism over their refusal to betray their bodies, minds, and spirits. There's another type of betrayal called institutional betrayal. Researchers explained that this type of betrayal occurs when, quote, an institution causes harm by action or inaction to an individual who trusts or depends upon that institution. Factors that contribute to institutional betrayal include strict membership requirements. We see that in military training or elite sports. The existence of prestige or power differentials, caregivers versus patients, clergy versus parishioners, and rigid priorities such as extreme efforts to protect the reputation of an organization. Perhaps the most devastating organizational betrayal is a cover-up. In Dare to Lead, I explain, cover-ups are perpetuated not only by the original actors, but by a culture of complicity and shame. Sometimes individuals are complicit because staying quiet or hiding the truth benefits them and or doesn't jeopardize their influence or power. Other times, people are complicit because it's the norm. They work in a cover-up culture that uses shame to keep people quiet. Either way, when the culture of a corporation, a nonprofit, a university, government, church, sports program, school, or family mandates that it's more important to protect the reputation of that system and those in power than it is to protect the basic human dignity of individuals or communities, you can be certain of the following problems. One, shame is systemic. Two, complicity is part of the culture. Three, money and power trump ethics. Four, accountability is dead. Five, control and fear are management tools. And last, you can be absolutely certain that there's a trail of devastation and pain. It's possible to heal betrayal, but it's rare because it requires significant courage and vulnerability to hear the pain we've caused without becoming defensive. In our research, we found that the only way back from betrayal is accountability, amends, and action. None of these things are possible without acknowledging the pain and possibly trauma that we've caused someone without rationalizing or making excuses. We're also much better as individuals and as a culture at shaming and blaming than we are at actual accountability. Let's dig a little bit deeper into defensiveness. At its core, defensiveness is a way to protect our ego and a fragile self-esteem. Our research team member Ellen Alley explains that our self-esteem is considered fragile when our failures, mistakes, and imperfections decrease our self-worth. In our work, the opposite of a fragile self-esteem is grounded confidence. With grounded confidence, we accept our imperfections and they don't diminish our self-worth. It makes sense that defensiveness occurs in areas of our lives where we have fragile self-esteem or across several areas of our lives if the fragility is more general. Any perceived call out of our weakness is experienced as an attack on our self-worth, so we fight hard to defend ourselves against it. In order to try to limit our exposure to information that differs from how we think of ourselves, we get defensive and over-justify, make excuses, minimize, blame, discredit, discount, refute, reinterpret. Defensiveness blocks us from hearing feedback and evaluating if we want to make meaningful changes in our thinking or behavior based on the input from other people. In our Dare to Lead training, we work with participants to figure out what defensiveness looks like for them, what it feels like, and whether there are some situations that are more likely to trigger it than others. To increase self-awareness, we ask folks to think back to a time when they received difficult feedback and try to remember what their bodies were doing, what thoughts were coming up, and what emotions they were feeling. The vast majority of people struggle to remember the exact thoughts and feelings, which makes sense, given that many of us go into fight or flight mode in these situations. However, for the most part, people can remember their physical responses, folding their arms over their chest, shoving their hands into their pockets, getting tunnel vision, feeling their heart race, looking down, getting dry mouth. These are just a few of the examples. It's worth thinking about the physical cues that show up for you when experiencing defensiveness and devising a strategy that can help you pull back into the present moment. When I get defensive, I get tunnel vision almost every time, and I start planning what I'm going to say instead of listening. but I have found a couple of ways to disarm my defensiveness. My strategy is to subtly open my palms, even if my hands are just hanging by my side or on my lap, and actually say, "I'm sorry, can you say that again? I really want to understand." It can look weird, but it's pretty effective. If I'm having a really hard time, I might say, "I'm sorry, I'm feeling overwhelmed. I'm going to get a glass of water. Can we sit down in 10 minutes and start over again?" This leads me right to our next section in this chapter, which is on flooding. This is a perfect place to talk about this concept. The body can become overwhelmed when it senses danger. And for a lot of us, a difficult conversation, hard feedback, arguments, it's enough to leave us feeling overwhelmed, attacked, and confused. According to the Gottman Institute, flooding is, quote, "a sensation of feeling psychologically and physically overwhelmed during conflict, making it virtually impossible to have a productive problem-solving discussion." In his book, Why Marriages Succeed or Fail and How You Can Make Yours Last, John Gottman explains, quote, "We each have a sort of built-in meter that measures how much negativity accumulates during such interactions. When the level gets too high for you, the needle starts going haywire and flooding begins. Just how readily people become flooded is individual." Gottman also shares that flooding is affected by how much stress you have going on in your life. The more pressure we're under, the more likely we are to be easily flooded. One of the worst patterns that I brought to my marriage from my family was, "Get back in here and fight with me right now." Growing up, we did not take breaks during fights. No one ever said, "Hey, this is no longer productive and we should take a time out before something bad is said or someone gets their feelings hurt." Our strategy was get louder and meaner until you win or someone else is crying. When I first married Steve, in the middle of a heated argument, he would say, "Hey, let's stop and take a break." I was like, "What are you talking about?" At some point, I think I realized that stopping the fight scared me. Fighting together seemed less painful than hurting alone. Looking back, I just didn't know how to do it. I had never been taught or seen it modeled. Gottman's work helped me understand the mechanics behind, okay, can we circle back in 20 minutes? Or, okay, how much time do you need? Knowing that we're coming back to finish the discussion and win is really reassuring to me in an important way. The research also helped me realize that it's not just Steve who gets overwhelmed. I get overwhelmed too. The difference is our strategies. He shuts down when he's flooded. I think I lash out, which is disastrous. I don't think I understood before I studied this that I thought flooding always caused shutting down. The haywire needle always meant like all systems shutting down. But I think when my needle goes haywire, I just lash out. It's a terrible combination. Now when I get flooded, I'm as likely to say timeout as he is. This is a good thing because according to Gottman, chronic flooding sets us up to dread communicating. Gottman discusses this effect in the context of marriages and partnerships, but I've seen the same thing in organizations. I've interviewed many research participants who experience chronic flooding with their bosses, so much so that every time they're called into the office, they're already on the path to overwhelm. There's just so much our bodies and nervous systems can stand before they flip the survival switch and stop communicating and start protecting or attacking. Looking back, and this is true, this is not hyperbole, y'all, I have never once regretted calling the time out at home or work, not once. I've never experienced a little time and space being a bad thing. I do, however, have a lot of regrets the other way around. Let's talk about hurt. I'm not sure there's a braver sentence in the human catalog of brave sentences than "my feelings are hurt." It's simple, vulnerable, and honest, but we don't say it very often. We get pissed off, we hurt back, or we internalize the hurt until we believe we deserve it and that something is wrong with us. But rarely do we say, "This really hurt my feelings." The definition of hurt from a team of researchers led by Anita Vangelisti goes a long way in explaining why acknowledging hurt is so difficult. They write, quote, individuals who are hurt experience a combination of sadness at having been emotionally wounded and fear of being vulnerable to harm. When people feel hurt, they have appraised something that someone said or did as causing them emotional pain. I want to read it again. It's so powerful, but so simple. So again, a definition of hurt that comes from a team of researchers led by Anita Evangelisti at the University of Texas at Austin. Individuals who are hurt experience a combination of sadness at having been emotionally wounded and fear of being vulnerable to harm. When people feel hurt, they have appraised something that someone said or did as causing them emotional pain. We all know that it's really scary to put our heart on the line and say, I feel wounded and sad about what happened yesterday and I'm afraid to get hurt again. It's deeply vulnerable, but it's also universal. All of us have felt this way, often and a lot. It's impossible to be in relationships and avoid ever feeling hurt, just as it's impossible to know love without knowing what it feels like to have a broken heart. Evangelisti and team explain that hurt happens through social interaction. In fact, hurt feelings are most often caused by people with whom we have close relationships when we feel devalued or rejected by the other person. Most behaviors that result in hurt feelings are not intended to be hurtful. They typically involve actions that are you ready? Thoughtless, careless, or insensitive. However, the more intentional an action is perceived, the more hurtful it feels. Our hurt feelings are typically experienced simultaneously with other emotions such as sadness, anger, anxiety, jealousy, or loneliness. As a result, they don't always feel the same way as most other emotions do. However, research indicates that even though hurt feelings are a mix of several emotions, they are a distinct emotional experience, not just a combination of other negative emotions. Let me say that again. The research indicates that even though hurt feelings are a mix of several emotions, they are a distinct emotional experience, not just a combination of negative emotions. As I was explaining this to my teenage son, all I could come up with is the rainbow snow cone analogy. There's grape, cherry, lime, lemon, orange, and blueberry. But you don't really taste all of those when you eat it. It just tastes like rainbow snow cone. Like, it's not a mix of all those flavors, it just becomes its own flavor. Our reactions to hurt feelings can be self-blaming, or we might cry, lash out, or retaliate by trying to hurt the other person and or seek out other relationships to find comfort. When reparation doesn't seem possible, hurt feelings can turn into anger or sadness. One thing that motivates me to be a little braver in how I handle my hurt feelings is research that shows that when we respond to hurt feelings with anger, the other person tends to match our anger with more anger. I can tell you that this has happened in my kitchen about 1,365 times. However, when repair seems possible and we share our hurt feelings and try to reconnect without the anger, the other person tends to respond with constructive actions, including apologies and amends. I've actually tried the I'm so pissed off right now because you're a jerk, but I'm going to say that my feelings are hurt, so you apologize right this second. But I don't.